Welcome to All About Jack. I'm Lee Moflaherty, your host. All About Jack is a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com and is celebrating 10 years of podcasting in 2021. Speaking of 2021, I'm featuring the first of a two-part episode highlighting the talks given at the recent Inglings Weekend in Montreat. It was held July 9th through the 11th. The theme was The Radio Broadcast at 80, A Celebration of Mere Christianity. On this show, I'm featuring the two talks given by Dr. Devin Brown, who has been a guest on many other occasions. See the show notes to be able to listen to those episodes. What follows is about 15 minutes of each of Devin's presentations. The first talk was entitled, The Story Behind Mere Christianity. And the second one was, Lewis's Arguments, Not Deductive but Abductive, and What That Might Mean for Us Today.
So I've got a bunch of quotes I'm going to work through, and I'm going to talk about the story behind mere Christianity. And I'll just say there's a lot more story than this. But the first track I'm going to go down is this one. From the time C.S. Lewis was young, wait, let's go backwards. C.S. Lewis, everyone knows here in this room, is one of the greatest Christian writers of the 20th century. Perhaps, what, the greatest, but certainly one of the greatest, everyone agrees. And it was clear from early on that he was going to be a writer. But what it wasn't clear was what? That he was going to be a Christian. Right? Here's a great Christian writer. He was always going to be a writer, but he wasn't always going to be a Christian. So I'm going to track down that story first and look at part one, his conversion to Christianity. All right? Let's begin. And where do you start his conversion to Christianity? Well, you can start when he's, christened at St. Mark's, and you could pick, well, you could start when his parents were born or got married. I don't know where to start. But let's start here in 1926. So Lewis has a diary. It's called All My Road Before Me. Most of you know that, right? And what's weird is there are only two mentions of Tolkien in it. And, oh, let me just go backwards. Remember me back in eighth grade reading C.S. Lewis? I find Tolkien then, and I say his name wrong for 25 years, right? And then I learn that it's Tolkien. You know, I'm keen on Tolkien. So for a while, I would say it correctly. And then in the middle of my talk, I'd go back to saying it wrong. It was just annoying. So I just said, heck, I'm just going to say Tolkien, right? And I'm in pretty good company. You'll hear Doug Gresham will say Tolkien once in a while. So anyway, into Merton for the English tea at 4. Tolkien, and there's his first mention on May 11, 1926, arranged to get the discussion round to the proposed English prelim. I had a talk with him afterwards. Hold on to those five or six words. I had a talk with him afterwards. All right? Because we're going to get a quote in the Four Loves that I think is referring to that very talk. And you know the rest, most of you. He's a smooth, pale, fluent little chap. Can't read Spencer because of the forms. And by the way, if you start studying Lewis, you start learning all sorts of stuff. So, what are these forms in Spencer? Well, I don't know. And you look up Spencer, and it's got to be Fairy Queen. And you go down to the forms, and apparently Spencer is quoting Chaucerian forms of English that aren't correct. And so, you know, drives Tolkien nuts. Can't read it. So there you go. Now you've learned about what he's objecting to, Tolkien is. Thinks language is the real thing in school. Thinks all literature is written for the amusement of men between 30 and 40. We ought to vote ourselves out of existence if we were honest. No harm in him. Only needs a smack or two. There's the famous quote. And by the way, this is pre-conversion Lewis, right? And finally, his pet abomination is the idea of liberal studies. And finally, look at the last one. Technical hobbies are more in his line, a reference to the kind of writing, right? And later on, Tolkien writes, for long, I thought this was only my personal hobby, right? Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, that kind of writing he did. Just a hobby to do. All right. A year later, in 27, he writes Arthur Greaves, we have a little Icelandic club in Oxford called the Kolbitar, an Icelandic word for old cronies who sit around the fire so close they look as if they were biting the coals. We have so far read the Younger Edda and the Volsungsaga. You will be able to imagine what a delight this is for me, right? And by the way, there's a nice little thing. You know, he's italicized, he's underlined it probably in his letter. And suggests what? There are most people saying, we're reading the Younger Edda and the Volsungsaga. I think, ew. Right? But Arthur Greaves gets how much he loves this. That there's a little subgroup that says the stuff that most people don't have time for delights us to like crazy. So he's joined the old Icelandic club with Tolkien less than a year later. All right. So then begins a long stretch where he becomes a theist, as everybody knows. In the Trinity term of 1929, possibly in 1930, those of you who know about that don't need me to tell you that in Alistair McGrath's book and Andrew Lazo both make the case that he's probably off by a year, and I think there's a good chance he is. Not that it matters, in my opinion. I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. And by the way, I've got footnotes here. That's Surprised by Joy. The first one was Collected Letters 1, and then All My Roads. But Lewis becomes a theist then. The first time everybody reads Surprised by Joy, they think that he's a Christian then, right? The most reluctant convert. I knelt and prayed, right? He's got a lot of New Testament imagery, right? He talks about being dragged in, kicking and struggling, and he talks about the prodigal. But there he just becomes a theist. Lewis might not have become a theist, but for the influence of Tolkien. And unless God provided somebody else, he surely wouldn't have become a Christian. He would have stopped right there. All right. So then we have September 19th, the stroll in Addison's Walk, a walk around Magdalen College. Again, three-quarters of you know exactly what I'm talking about, no more than I am. But for the quarter that don't, there's a nice walk. You can do it when you go there. By the way, I've always wanted to go back there. I know this is hokey. There's like a hokey good with Lewis, right? It's like Christmas. There's a hokey good at Christmas. Anyway, so I've always wanted to go back there on September 19th, right? Sometime when I'm not teaching in September, and go out at that time of night and kind of do it again. It'd probably be raining or shut, right? And I think, anyway. So he has this important talk. 3 days later, he writes Arthur Greaves about it. I couldn't write you last Sunday because I had a weekend guest, a man called Dyson who teaches at Reading, right? So Tolkien and Dyson are there. Tolkien came due, did not leave until 3 in the morning. And by the way, so when you read about these guys stayed up late. I mean, two things. They really drank quite a bit of beer. Not just like one. They drank a lot and drank it often. And they stayed up late. And I'm thinking, yeah, they're like my college students, right? Except they got a lot of work done. We began an Addison's Walk just after dinner on metaphor and myth, interrupted by a rush of wind which came so suddenly on the still warm evening and sent so many leaves pattering down that we thought it was raining. We all held our breath. And most of you have read that a number of times, and every time I read it, I think, yeah, I know it doesn't always work like, because that seems like a scene from a movie, right? This big moment that's going to be the pivot around which Lewis's whole life will swing, and, you know, he mentions the leaves. And I think, that's a great movie scene. Anyway, my life doesn't usually work like that. No angel music, no windy. Anyway, we continued in my room on Christianity, a long, satisfying talk in which I learned a lot. Now, Lewis is usually really good with letters, but I know he's busy. Anyway, you don't write somebody and say, I learned a lot, and stop there. Maybe he's still processing it. I don't know. On the 28th of September, they go from Warney's brother and friends. Today, the family paid its long-projected visit to Whipstead Zoo. And most of you know the story. Lewis has had this talk, and he gets in the sidecar, and they drive to Whipstead Zoo, and he'll tell you down below what happens. Warney first in number 8B. I remember well the day in 1931 when we made a visit to Whipstead Zoo, Jack riding in my sidecar. It was during that outing that he made his decision to rejoin the church. Okay, so we lock it into that date. Possibly, I'll just say, since we're scholars, it's possibly that Warney is looking at his diary and hearing what Lewis wrote and connecting those two, but maybe not. Anyway, I like the comment next. This seemed to me no sudden plunge into a new life, but rather a slow, steady convalescence from a deep-seated spiritual illness of long standing. One of my favorite things about Lewis's conversion is it's, well, not so much like we always picture conversion today. Right? He didn't answer an altar call. It didn't happen in a moment. And it's not the kind of thing you repeat. And we kind of like to do that. We kind of like to say, oh yeah, here's how we're going to convert people. We're going to have a revival and we're going to invite them down to the altar. And that's how God is going to work. And he may work that way. Some of you may work that way in your life. You can point to a time and a date where you came down and responded to an altar call. But we could go the other way. Oh, let's see. You want to be converted. Okay. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to walk around this walk outside of Oxford really late in the night, right? And then a week later, you're going to get in a sidecar and drive to a zoo. And when you get to the zoo, you'll be a Christian, right? Right? That's the kind of nuttiness. To say God has to work in the same way all the time. It's a great story. All right. So anyway, Lewis will write again and explain it. On October 1st, he says, my dear Arthur, I've just passed on from believing in God to definitely believing in Christ, in Christianity. My long night talk with Dyson and Tolkien had a great deal to do with it. And then that's all he says. And then 17 days later, he says, what had been holding me back? That's a great question. What's holding Lewis back from becoming a Christian? Right? Lots of people are held back. What held him back may have been a factor in yours. Maybe yours was nothing like this. Most of you know this story. The last year or so, Not so much a difficulty in believing as a difficulty in knowing what the doctrine meant. You can't believe a thing while you're ignorant what the thing is. My puzzle was the whole doctrine of redemption. In what sense the life and death of Jesus saved or opened up salvation to the world? I couldn't see was how the life and death of someone else, whoever he was, 2,000 years ago, could help us here and now, except so far as his example helped us. What Dyson and Tolkien showed me was this. The idea of the dying and reviving God moved me, provided I met it anywhere except the Gospels. It's one of my favorite Lewis's phrase. Because we've got lots of people today are ready to hear good messages, be moved by it. They'll go to Star Wars, they'll go to an uplifting concert, and they'll find it very meaningful. But something has turned them off to the faith, right? That even if it's the same message there, they'll just be closed to it. Provided I met it anywhere except the Gospel. And let's just say one thing about that. It took a Tolkien and a Dyson to point that out to him, right? Your average person couldn't have said, yeah, Lewis, you're a bigot, right? You're prejudiced against this thing. And I get why. You grew up in a Sunday school that was boring and not particularly authentic. Stained glass associations, he'll talk later. But you're blocking that without letting... Early on, he says, I let go of the reins. And that's a great line in Surprise by Joy. He unbuckles and he said, let go of the reins. Which was to say he was directing what he would believe in. He was not following truth wherever it led. He let go of the reins and let it go where it would lead him. Anyway, I was prepared to meet that story. Oh, that really moves me. Provided I met it anywhere but the Gospels. The reason was that in pagan stories, I was prepared to feel the myth as profound and suggestive of meanings beyond my grasp, even though I could not say in cold prose what it meant. So he's hitting the redemption of Christ, and he says, I can't quite grasp exactly what it means. And the answer is, well, let it be a mystery. All you have to do is accept that it was, you don't have to understand exactly how it was. Now I get, and Lewis does too, that there'll be certain denominations that want to explain exactly how it works. And maybe that's fine for him, but for him, it's got to be a bit of a mystery, like what moves you in the Lord of the Rings. A bit of a mystery. Anyway, now the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference that it really happened. One must be content to accept it in the same way. When he says one, of course, he means I have to. He doesn't mean you have to. Maybe you will find a doctrine that explains it perfectly for you. But for him, he had to just leave it at that. All right. So this is, what, 31. 11 years later, he's going to broadcast this in the second series of talks. As Hal said, we're almost 10 years. This August, from the very first broadcast that goes out, will be 80 years this August, right? But this is the second series in 1942, and later on it gets published in Mere Christianity, but he comes back to this sticking point. And what we hear is without Tolkien, to get him past this thing, he's still stuck there on the other side of faith. So 10 years later, he says this. Now, before I became a Christian, I was under the impression that the very first thing Christians had to believe was one particular theory as to what the point of the dying was. According to that theory, God wanted to punish men for having deserted and joined the great rebel, but Christ volunteered to be punished instead, and so God let us off. What I came to see later on was neither this theory nor any other is Christianity. The central Christian belief is that Christ's death has somehow, I should have underlined that in Lewis, has somehow put us right with Christ, right? Put us right with God and give us a fresh start. A good many theories have been held as to how it works, but what Christians are agreed on is that it does work. Now, most of you read Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. Some of you have taught it. And when you get to the deep magic and the deeper magic, and you try to explain the deeper magic, you know, the deeper magic, which the witch didn't know, which is, you know, is that if a traitor dies, someone who's not guilty dies. And you'll see that Lewis doesn't quite spell it out there either. I'm telling you, if you go really close, you get it, but you don't get it how exactly it works. He leaves it. Death starts working backwards. Okay, what does that mean? He doesn't exactly say, does he? All right, anyway. I'm going backwards for only one time. Before he does this talk, he gives his talks out to a Catholic and a Methodist, and I don't know what the other one was, Orthodox, I think. Anyway, he sends it to Dom Bede Griffiths, his friend who's Catholic. Now about the scripts. He had sent the scripts for the second series of talks, What Christians Believe. Yes, I think I gave the impression of going further than I intended in saying that all the theories of the atonement were, quote, to be rejected if we don't find them helpful. What I meant was, need not be used. A very different thing. And so this thing is still for him. If there's a doctrine that really spells out how redemption works, for you and it works, good. But if none of those work, they need not be used. All you have to accept it. Take a look at this one. I dug this one up, 10D. Some of you may have not made this connection. But here's Lewis a month before he's going to die, right? October 31st, what, 3 weeks before he passes. And he still writes letters, right? He writes this guy, Mr. Young, an American, who's asked him a couple questions. And here's what he says just weeks before he goes to his maker. I think the ideas of sacrifice, ransom, championship over death, substitution, and if those of you who have studied theology know exactly what he means by all those things, are all images to suggest the reality, not otherwise comprehensible to us, of the atonement. To fix on any one of them as if it contained and limited the truth like a scientific definition would, and here he's great again, in my opinion, be a mistake. All right. So again, he's saying, if that works for you, fine, but for me it didn't. And we're reminded, yes, and it didn't, and that's what had been holding you back, and without Tolkien coming there, well, we might not have had all these works, right? There's a famous quote after Lewis dies. It's a famous passage that people quote from one of Lewis' letters. One of Tolkien's letter. Tolkien, even though he's older than Lewis, he outlives him by quite a bit. I think he was a little healthier lifestyle if you want to go into that.
Now here's part of Devin's second talk.
Today I'm going to talk about C.S. Lewis's arguments, not deductive but abductive, and what this might mean for us today. Before I get going, I want to mention I got most of what I got from these two books right here. The first one is The Morals of the Story, and it's sitting right there if you're interested. It's by David and Mary Beth Baggett. And then Alistair McGrath's book, The Intellectual World of C.S. Lewis. Both of them taught me something I didn't know before, which is what an abductive argument is. And all of a sudden you're thinking, really, this is going to be that kind of talk. I'll try to not make it so much that kind of talk, but it's going to be somewhat, but stay with me. Finally, I'll say this. I gave this talk for the Warren Apologetics Center, and they made, and a couple others, they made a little booklet out, if you're interested. I would assume most of you will have had enough of abductive arguments by the end, but if you're looking for more, well, actually, for more, what you should turn to is, you know, the first of these two books, and then there. All right. Part one, infinite importance or no importance. There are a number of famous Lewis quotes that get cited again and again, and guess what? I'm going to cite them again today, and you've already heard them, and I know that, right? The first quote comes from a talk called Christian Apologetics that Lewis gave in 1945 to an assembly of Anglican priests and youth ministers. The first quote comes from Christian Apologetics, right, that Lewis gives in 1945 to an assembly of Anglican priests and youth leaders. It's later published in God and the Doc, as well, all of you already know, right? And here's a quote. One of the greatest difficulties is to keep before the audience mind the question of truth. They always think you are recommending Christianity, not because it's true, but because it's good. And actually, this isn't the most famous quote that comes from here, but it's worth talking about. Lewis's point here is that we've all been in conversations where you start out discussing some aspect of whether Christianity is true. Could be anything, the existence of God or anything. But before you know it, the person you're talking to wants to talk about whether Christianity is good. That's Lewis's point. And by good, sometimes they're very conscientious and good, but by good, they don't really mean the teachings of Christianity, whether they're good. They want to mean whether, well, the followers of Christianity are good, right? And let's be honest, some of these conversations, they don't really mean the followers in general. The millions of people who get up every day and try to love their neighbor as themselves and try to do what God would want, they mean the few people who say they're Christians, but really, don't try to follow Christ at all. That's who they mean. And before you know it, you're talking about the Spanish Inquisition and televangelists who have $500 haircuts. That's what Lewis is saying here, right? All right. One of the great difficulties is to keep before the audience's mind the question of truth. They always think you are recommending Christianity, not because it is true, because it is good. But here's the more famous quote. One must keep on pointing out that Christianity, if false, is of no importance, and if true, of infinite importance, and the one thing it cannot be is of moderate importance. Christianity, if true, is of infinite importance. And if it is such great importance, we should give great attention not only that we share the faith, but how we share the faith. And as we'll see, Lewis, by example, is going to offer us both a message and, you might call it, a manner or a method, and that's where I'm going to go today. Now, it's good to be here. Very good to be here. And you can't help but make the metaphor. We're having a mountaintop experience, right? Literally, metaphorically, all those things. And that said, it's great to be here. And You know, people before us have said those very words. It's really good to be here. Let's build a tabernacle, right? But we're going to go out into the world. And how we go out into the world is important, because Christianity is of great importance, right? And as much as we'd like to, you know, stay here and hang around with all Lewis people the rest of our lives, maybe that's not where God's called us to be, right? And I'll just say this. You're going to be giving Lewis talks, and you're going to be sharing the Lord with people. And there's lots of ways to share God with people. When I was a kid, I thought there was only one way. It's the way my church kind of did it. They would knock on doors and give people these tracts. And my observation was, one, I didn't like doing that, and two, it didn't seem to be particularly effective. Later in life, I ran across the quote by Francis of Assisi, share the gospel at all times. If necessary, preach. But share the gospel at all. And so there's many, many ways to share the gospel. And only a few of them involve preaching or giving out tracts. One of the great difficulties is keep before the audience mind the question of truth. Of course, this means that we must get our audience, or whoever we are speaking to engage and respond with their minds and not just their emotions, as often is the case. And I'll just say the problem, if they respond emotionally, it's very hard for you not to respond emotionally. And before you know it, right? If you haven't read into them or run across them already, it's very highly likely you're going to meet people who can be said to be reasoning resistant, right? Another way to talk about these people is they're evidence resistant, right? Perhaps they're resistant to reasoning or evidence because they simply don't think about these kind of things. You know, not everybody thinks the way you might or I might. They might think more about the immediate demands of the moment, where they need to be and what they have to do each day. In this case, Lewis might suggest we should start with something that they are thinking about. Alternate, perhaps they are resistant to reasoning because of previous encounters they have had with Christians. Christians who in their presentation of the faith have been, well, self-righteous, overly dogmatic, heavy-handed, or simply, well, let's be honest, unpleasant. Right? And I'm reminded of a passage from The Silver Chair. All right. If you know the opening, Jill has been bullied at school. She's behind the gym crying. And that was why Jill was crying on that dull autumn day in the damp little patch which runs between the back of the gym and the shrubbery. And she had nearly finished her cry when a boy came around the corner of the gym whistling with his hands in his pockets. He nearly ran into her. "Can't you look where you're going?" said Jill Pohl. "All right," said the boy. "You needn't start." And then he noticed her face. "I say, Pohl," he said. "What's up?" She only made faces, the sort you make when you're trying to say something, but find if you do speak, you'll start crying again. "Oh, it's them, I suppose, as usual," said the boy, grimly digging his hands further into his pockets. Jill nodded. There was no need for her to say anything, even if she could have said it. They both knew. "Now look here," said the boy. "There's no good us all." He meant well. But he did rather talk like someone beginning a lecture. And suddenly Jill flew into a temper. I tell you, that's been me. I've meant well. That's been you. We've meant well. But we did sound like someone beginning a lecture. And what was needed was not a lecture. Lewis knows all about that. If you've taught anything in writing, the first thing you want to do is convince your students that writing an argument doesn't mean you're argumentative, right? The thing that you do in the English class, you know, how's your argument? They go, like the kind of thing I do with my brother? No, 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 this is a different one. That said, when we're making an argument for the case for Christianity, we often find it gets argumentative. All right. Luke suggests that when we share our faith, not just our message, but our manner itself can help make Christianity seem plausible to those we encounter. Let's go the opposite direction. Lewis suggests that no matter what our message, sometimes our manner itself helps make the case that Christianity isn't really plausible. By the way we do it, we're convincing them, no, there's nothing there for me. Right? As we'll see, Lewis will give us an example of this might look like. All right, here we go. Stay with me. As many of you know, there are three kinds of reasoning, right? Deductive, where the conclusion is true if the premises are true. Inductive, where the conclusion can be strengthened but never proven. And I'm going to go through all of these. And then abductive, which until like 3 years ago I'd never heard of, and which I'm kind of fond of right now. That's what I'm going to talk about today, and I learned it from Alistair McGrath and David Bagman here. All right, let's take a look at all of these. And the first one is one you've already seen, probably deductive reasoning. There's two premises and one conclusion. We move from the general to the specific, usually. And the conclusion is true if the premises are true. Here's a typical example. People who are colorblind cannot see certain colors. Joe is colorblind. Joe cannot be certain colors, right? And if in fact, where's Sharon's pointer? If we agree this is true, and if we agree this is true, then the conclusion has to be true, right? And people often think that's what Lewis is doing, making this kind of argument. For a long time, I did too, until some people convinced that's not really what he does. And there's a reason he doesn't do that. No. Here's the opening of Mere Christianity, chapter 1, the law of human nature. Everyone has heard people quarreling. Sometimes it sounds funny, and sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant, but however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kind of things they say. They say things like, how'd you like it if anyone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was here first. Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. These are the opening words of the first BBC talk. Later, they become the opening words from my book here, Mere Christianity. Rather than beginning with the Bible, or with doctrines, or with those tracts that my church used to give out, where we talk about topics like atonement and sin and the deity of Christ, Lewis begins with something all people everywhere have experienced every day and can relate to. Everyone has heard people quarreling, and they have. Lewis begins by describing how during an argument, when one person tries to convince someone else that they should or should not have done something, the first person is not merely saying that the second person's behavior didn't happen to please him. Instead, the person is saying that, well, there's this standard of right and wrong which the second person has violated. And here is Lewis's point. The first person expects the second person not only to already know about this standard, but to accept it as the standard by which human actions are judged. That's the whole point of the opening. Another way to answer this quarreling, as Lewis points out, means trying to show the other person has done something wrong. And the accused person almost never makes the case, well, you know, I don't believe in right and wrong. They either say, well, I didn't do that thing you say, or there was some justification for doing what you say, but they never say, why do you act as though doing this thing is you know, right or wrong? These actions are just fine. And they also never say, right or wrong, everyone knows these are just things that are made up, right? Instead, the accused person tries to argue that they didn't violate this standard that both of them somehow already know and already agreed to. Lewis pointed that there would be no reason to have a quarrel unless the two people had a shared understanding of what right and wrong are. Quarreling requires some kind of right and wrong that exists beyond our personal wants and wishes. In Mere Christianity, Lewis calls this sense of right and wrong in us the law of human nature. And, you know, not a good title. We today, or it isn't now, it would have been back then, because the law of human nature, I think, sounds something bad. It's just human nature, right, to do things like this. Today we might call these things objective moral truths, and we might make the argument that the existence of objective moral truths might point to the existence of God and call that thing the moral argument. Here's one way to state it. If there is no God, there can be no objective moral truths. But there are objective moral truths, so there must be a God. As we'll see, denial of one or both of these presidents is where we find problems with talking to others about the moral argument. Deductive reasoning requires everybody agreeing on the first two premises being true. Some people might suggest, well, moral truths can exist without requiring that God exists. Now, I don't know how they do that, but they do, right? Or others may object to the idea that our shared views of right and wrong could be better called something else. Herd instinct, conventional wisdom, right? Lewis points out that what we see as moral laws, others may say, are just social conventions that they're taught into you by parents and teachers and society. They don't just exist outside of us. Here's a second, slightly different version. Objective morality cannot exist unless God exists. But objective morality exists. Therefore, God exists. Now, that kind of makes sense to me. But even back in Lewis's time, it didn't work with people who are not believers particularly, at least not in this form. All right. Lewis has a couple objections that he'll just jump right into. If you're going through Mere Christianity, he'll speak about two objections. I want to raise two more that kind of come up with this. Here's one that kind of comes up with the moral argument. Hey, I know many moral people who don't believe in God. Are you saying atheists can't be moral, or that Christians are more moral than atheists? Well, this is a great point. The very fact that atheists recognize moral laws and follow them is actually further support that there are objective moral truths that we all recognize. It's not just the church that recognizes them, but all sorts of people recognize them, right? And they're not something that people make up. The Bible supports this idea. Romans 2:15, Paul refers to the law that's written on everyone's heart. John 1:9 refers to the light that gives light to everyone. So we should not be surprised. We should actually expect to find atheists who are very moral people. Another way to answer this objection is to say, no one's arguing that atheists can't be morally good. That's not the point. Clearly they can. Absolutely they can. And let's go another step, right? I'm sure we can find atheists that are more moral than you and me, right? The moral argument brings to light is that atheists have trouble saying that what they believe is right and wrong is more than just their personal preference, or that what they believe in right or wrong should apply to everyone. And I'm going to get into some particular examples in a little bit, but one of my best friends is a computer science teacher.
Sorry to say that I'm ending the recording there. However, I'm hoping to be able to share the complete video recordings of both of Devin's talks in the near future on my YouTube channel. Thank you for listening to this special episode of All About Jack, feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of this podcast. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. The YouTube channel I mentioned a moment ago is called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a general link in the show notes to it. If I'm able to post the complete video versions of the talks, then I will update the show notes with a direct link. Today you heard about 15 minutes each of part of what Dr. Devin Brown gave at the 2021 Inklings Weekend in Montreat. You'll find links in the show notes that will enable you to hear other times Devin has been a guest, as well as other shows related to the Inklings Fellowship. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.